You know when your customers are shopping at your business and they pick up a product? The customer holds it, feels it, and shows it to their friend. Then they look at the price tag.
Oh my, I need to look at something else.
The customer picks up a second item and loves the way it looks. They've heard of this product, but haven't yet seen it in person.
I've got to have this!
You're happy the customer chose to buy a product, but you're equally frustrated that they didn't buy both items.
I want them both.
The Consumer Experience Lab at Barbera Solutions designs behavioral strategies that target the consumer's decision-making process. BarberaSolutions.com. Because the opposite of rational is not irrational. BarberaSolutions.com. Why is the shopping cart always in the top right of the screen?
How do companies predict my purchases?
Why do prices end in 9?
Why do fast food companies use red and yellow in their logos?
Why do restaurants always have one expensive menu item?
Researchers, marketers, and very curious people seek the answers for how we make decisions and how we choose products. ClickSuasion finds the secrets that companies use and shares them with you.
Why do I feel better when I bought the last remaining airline ticket?
How do I make choices based on colors and fonts?
Welcome to ClickSuasion. This is Michael Barbera. Today's guest is Dan Pink. Dan is the author of 6 provocative books, including the newest, When: The Scientific Secrets of Perfect Timing, which is scheduled to be published January 2018. His other books include the long-running New York Times bestseller, A Whole New Mind, and the number one New York Times bestseller, Drive and to Sell as Human. His books have won multiple awards and have been translated into 35 languages. I'm not sure I could list 35 languages. Dan lives in Washington, D.C. with his wife and their 3 children. Dan, welcome to ClickSuasion.
Thank you, Michael. Thanks for having me.
Oh, thanks for being here. So let's just get right to it. Let's just talk When. Tell us about When, The Scientific Secrets of Perfect Timing.
Well, this is a book that is about, as you listeners have already figured out, timing. We all know that timing is everything. I think a lot of people agree with that. The trouble is that we think that timing is an art. And I have found, after 2 years of very painful research, that timing is actually a science. That there is this rich body of research across many, many fields, biology, psychology, economics, anthropology, endocrinology, that allows us to understand timing better and make systematically wiser when decisions. So everything from when should you exercise during the day, when should or should you not go into a hospital, when should your kid take a standardized test, when should you abandon a project, when, if you're managing a project, should you, you know, intervene to get people going. Why do beginnings matter so much? How do endings affect our behavior? How do groups synchronize in time? So just a whole array of research and action items on this topic, timing, that we think is elusive and haphazard, but that we can begin actually to get our arms around.
You raised an eyebrow. I like to go to the hospital when something is adverse or something is wrong.
That's generally a good move. Yeah.
Tell me when I should not go to a hospital and why.
Well, if you can avoid it, don't go to the hospital in the afternoon. Now, here's why. Don't go. Let me tell you, this is startling stuff here. So you are, not you, Michael, but people are 4 times more likely to have an error in anesthesia at 3 p.m. versus 9 a.m. Doctors, nurses are far less likely to wash their hands in the afternoon versus the morning. Doctors are far more likely to prescribe unnecessary antibiotics during afternoon appointments than they are during morning appointments. Colonoscopies, doctors looking at the same patient population will find half as many polyps in afternoon colonoscopies as they will in morning colonoscopies. So where possible, where you have a choice, try to avoid going to the hospital or even to a doctor in the afternoon. You're better off going in the morning. Now, obviously, if you get hit by a bus, go to the hospital shortly after getting hit by that bus. I wouldn't wait till I think time of day matters less. But for some of these more discretionary things, avoid hospitals in the afternoon.
Okay, so the takeaway, the lesson learned here is don't get hit by a bus in the afternoon.
Right, although I think the general principle of avoid getting hit by buses is pretty good too.
I would agree with you. Yeah. I'm not going to argue. I will try to avoid buses.
Yeah.
So timing obviously is important. And you mentioned a lot of fields where timing affects.
Yeah.
Now you have a lot of work in policy, economics, entrepreneurship, sales, persuasion. How does timing affect businesses and say entrepreneurs?
There's so many different ways. Let me tell you about a few, because you know there are different ways to think about timing. I write a little bit in this book I write about timing over the course of a day, but I also write about timing in a broader sense about, you know, really a lot about beginnings, middles, and ends. But let's focus on this unit of a day. One of the things that the science tells us very clearly is that when it comes to work, our work, the actual things we do on the job, the kind of things that entrepreneurs do on the job, all times are not created equal. That time of day explains about 20% of the variance in performance on cognitive tasks. Okay. So what does that mean? Does that mean timing is everything? No, but it's a big thing. 20% is a pretty big source of that variance. So one thing that you can do if you're running a company or, you know, you're working individually is this. You have to recognize that the day has a hidden pattern. It's essentially, we essentially have during our waking hours, a three-act day. What I like to call the peak, the trough, and the recovery. The peak, the trough, and the recovery. Now, some of this depends on whether you're a morning person or an evening person, but we can get to that later. But the gist of it is that basically 4 out of 5 of us are either morning people or somewhere in between. A minority of us are evening people, but we'll get to that in a second. For most of us, the day follows that pattern, a peak, a trough, a rebound. If you're a strong evening person, it actually goes the opposite direction, recovery, trough, peak. But what the science tells us very clearly is that during each of those three periods, there are certain kinds of work that you'll do better on. So in the peak, which again, for most of us is the morning, we are much better off doing analytic tasks. Tasks like writing a report or auditing a financial statement. During the trough, which is the early to mid-afternoon, we're at our worst then. So you're better off doing administrative things, responding to email, filing, whatever. And then during the recovery, the science shows, is that we're actually better off on what are called insight problems. Problems that are not so much analytical, but require a little bit more looseness, a little bit more creativity. And so one of the things that happens in any kind of workplace is that we focus a lot on what people do. We got to know what people are doing. In many cases, we have whole education and training departments to say, okay, how are they doing it? We have HR departments saying, who are they doing it with? But we give this question of when they're doing it short shrift. We say this question of when is sitting at the kids' table, and it actually belongs at the grown-up table.
I'm just here shaking my head because now I know that my calendar is probably all messed up, and after this podcast, I'm going to go back to my calendar and start moving things all around.
But you know what? I mean, there's an argument for that. Okay, so for instance, let's talk about your own, Michael, your own chronotype. I'm going to ask you a question. We'll figure out whether you're a lark or an owl. We can do it. I mean, there's a more systematic questionnaire that you can do, but there's a thumbnail way to figure it out. So take a day when you don't have to wake up to an alarm. Take a day when you don't have to wake up to, like, you know, on a weekend or something like that, where you don't have to be up at a certain time. What time do you typically go to sleep on those kinds of days?
On the actual day when I don't wake up, or the night before?
The night before, yeah. So the next morning, you don't have to wake up to an alarm clock to go to a job or catch a flight or whatever. You just, you know, for some people, that's the weekend. So what time do you typically go to sleep the night before?
Probably between midnight and 2 a.m.
Okay, so let's take 1 a.m., all right? And then what time do you typically wake up?
Probably about the next morning, 9-ish. 9:30-ish.
Okay. So what I'm calculating here is the midpoint of your sleep. So the midpoint of your sleep would be, let's see here, 4, let's say you sleep 4 hours, 4 gets you to 5. The midpoint of your sleep would be 5 a.m. Okay? The midpoint of your sleep, that's right. The midpoint of your sleep would be 5 a.m. All right? So there's a chart in the book, but basically that would make you You're almost a full-fledged owl. You're not quite. You're what I call, you would actually fall into the category of what I call a third bird, right? So you got larks who are morning people, owls who are evening people, and then the majority of us are third birds. So you're a third bird. You're a fairly owly third bird. So your pattern is going to be peak trough recovery, but you probably want to start your day a little bit later. So what I would do is on a regular work day, I would start it, you know, in the morning. I wouldn't start your work at like 7:30 in the morning, maybe closer to 9 or 9:30, and do and really put your analytic work, whatever you have to do that requires heads down focus, do that in the morning. You know, take a lunch break. After lunch, that's when you do your administrative stuff, when you respond to your email, maybe do some scheduling to the extent you have to like file things away, fill out forms, whatever, do it then. And then in your recovery, which would likely be in the late-ish afternoon, early evening, do things that require a little bit more creativity. So if you want to brainstorm about ideas for a new podcast, if you want to develop ideas for some kind of new campaign of something else that you're working on. That's how, if you want to sit down with other people, especially in brainstorm, you're better off doing it later. You are better off doing it later in the afternoon. But again, the whole point here is that, you know, in order to be effective on the job, you have to know what you need to do, how to do it well, who you need to help you out. But you also need to figure out when to do it. It's as important a question. It's not more important a question, but it's as important a question.
Do you believe that employees will take your book as a doctor's note to their employers to try and sleep in a little later?
You know what? If they do, God bless them, because there's an argument for that. In fact, there is actually some very interesting research. There's a whole field out there called chronobiology, C-H-R-O-N-O, time, chronobiology, which is the study of our circadian rhythms, basically our daily rhythms, which are affected by a whole cocktail of things in our body, from our body temperature to our hormones, et cetera, et cetera. And what there's perhaps the world's best known chronobiologist, a guy named Till Ronenberg, who's in Munich. He has worked with a few German companies to essentially allow that, you know, sort of help them reconfigure their schedules so they match people's chronotypes. And he has found when you do that, productivity goes up. So, you know, there's certain kinds of businesses where that might be difficult to do. If you have a store that needs to be opened at 8 a.m, someone needs to be there to open up the store. But you're better off putting your morning people, obviously, in that 8 a.m. slot, and your owlier people later in the day. Where this comes up big time, I'll stop there. So actually, if people want to use this as a doctor's note to sleep in, I actually don't have a problem with that. There's some emerging evidence that allowing people to tailor their schedules to their own patterns makes them better workers.
So this reminds me of a school district in Colorado who is advocating or setting a policy to start the school day later in the day to allow kids to get more sleep in a little more. And then so very much along the lines of what you're advocating for in your research. Do you have a dog in this fight?
No, I don't have a dog in this fight, and my family doesn't have a dog, but we do have a 15-year-old son, and that's actually very germane, exactly what you just said, Michael. There is an enormous amount, and this is this is in chapter 3 of the book. There's an enormous amount of evidence out there about school start times in adolescence. Let me take two steps backward. When you think about kids up until the age of basically kids up until the age of about 12, 13, pre-puberty kids tend to be very larky. They tend to be morningish people. They wake up early, fade out fairly early in the evening. But at puberty, there's a fairly dramatic change in most people's chronobiology. Their biology shifts forward a few hours. So they naturally wake up way later and they go to sleep way later. So there's a period of peak owliness that goes from about puberty to, you know, 23, 24 years old. And so pushing back school start times for 7-year-olds, that's not a good idea. I mean, I don't think it's that harmful, but I don't think you need to do that. Pushing back school start times for, you know, late middle school and high school, that's a very good idea. In fact, the American Academy of Pediatrics in 2014 issued a policy statement saying, recommending to school districts across America, do not start school for middle schoolers or high schoolers before 8:30 in the morning. That is the, so think about the pediatricians of the world of America linking arms and saying, please, please, please. Everything we know about biology tells us, do not start school for this age group before 8:30. And yet, two out of three schools in America, the median school start time in America is 8:03 a.m. So I'm for that. Now, pushing back the school start time doesn't mean, like, well, let's start it at 1 in the afternoon. What it means is that it means starting it at, say, 9:15. 9:30. And what's interesting about that is that when you look, there's a lot of research on this. What this shows is that when you push back school start times, even by that modest amount, fewer dropouts, higher test scores, less depression, better physical health. I mean, fewer teenage driving accidents. It's really quite remarkable.
I'm just really quite impressed that the mean comes out to 8:03 a.m.
Yeah. I don't know. I actually don't remember whether it's the mean or the median, but regardless, it's, I don't think there's probably much of a difference. But yeah, 8:03. Well, what's interesting about that is that what it means is that most schools are not following the guidelines of America's pediatricians. That's, to me, is what's most disturbing about it.
That is, you know, thinking back to my own high school days, which is kind of, you know, struggling for me right now. I don't think we started school before 8:30. I think the actual first bell rang at 8:30. I remember being there earlier than that. Wow. Now, I'm a New York City school child, so I'm not sure if anything's changed in New York City since I left there many years ago.
Well, I'll give you an example from my own high school where I went to high school. I went to a public school in Central Ohio, and I don't remember exactly when we started, but it was, you know, fairly early, not like, you know, 6 a.m. early, but fairly early. And I remember having first period French class, first period in Mademoiselle Inglis's class. And, you know, she would always say, you know, sort of warm us up, like, you know, comment allez-vous, you know, how are you? And, you know, in this first period French class, this group of like 16, 17-year-olds, everybody's answer every day, how are you, was, je suis fatigué, I'm tired. Everybody was fatigué because it was first period and they were 16 years old.
That's too much for me. That's too cognitively taxing for me to do that early in the morning.
Yeah.
English is probably too taxing for me to do that early in the morning.
Listen, now think about being 16 and having this dramatic change in your chronobiology and essentially being somewhat asleep and being forced to perform at those early, early hours. Again, this is for a relatively, just to be very clear, this is basically for, you know, post puberty young people. If you look at the chart of you know, people's waking times and rising times during this period between about 14 and 24, you know, almost everybody just wakes up later and goes to sleep later. It's not about laziness. It's not about social pressure. It's not about screen time. It's all about biology.
So your personal experiences with time obviously go back to your high school days. How many adverse situations do you believe you've stumbled into before being more aware of time?
That's an interesting question. I think, you know, one of the things I found in writing this book is that, I think I became more aware of time. You know, it was one of those things that I think for most of my life was kind of invisible. I always considered it this secondary or tertiary question. I mean, I was maniacal about, okay, what should I be doing? How should I be doing it? But the when of my work and other aspects of my life, I don't think I really took that seriously. I began to get an inkling that it was important and, you know, and then realized, oh my gosh, this is really, really important. But I think that, you know, doing this research made me aware of it. And that's one of the things that I hope to do for readers. It's just make them aware that of some of these timing issues. I'll give you one example that goes beyond the pattern of the day. So, you know, I find myself in, you know, everybody who's listening, the millions of ClickSuasion listeners out there have said something like the following to somebody. I've got some good news and some bad news.
I've never said that.
No. Good news and some bad news. So which should you give first, the good news or the bad news?
I would assume the bad news.
Why is that?
Get it out of the way and then end on a high note and end on a good note.
You are exactly right. You must have read When, The Scientific Secrets of Perfect Timing. That's exactly right. The here's what's interesting about it. Most people give the good news first. And it makes sense. Hear me out here. Why I think they do it. I don't have evidence of this. I'm just guessing. It's uncomfortable giving bad news, right? You know, you don't want to be a jerk. You want to lay down a cushion before giving the bad news. But if you ask people this question, which do you want to hear first, the good news or the bad news? Most people want the bad news first. And it's precisely the reason that you say that that given a choice, human beings prefer endings that elevate. We prefer rising sequences to declining sequences. And this preference for those kinds of, you know, and this is another example of timing in a broader sense, that endings affect our behavior in some really peculiar and interesting ways. So, for instance, there's some interesting research showing that what happens at the end of someone's life is how people remember them. So you have people who were, led good, you know, who are really great people and are kind of jerks for the final couple of years of their life. They get remembered as jerks rather than as good people, that the good people that they were for most of their life. The converse is also true. That you have people who were jerks through most of their lives who suddenly start behaving themselves in the final 2 years of their life, they're remembered as pretty good people. So endings help us encode. They help us record and evaluate entire experiences. And you see this, again, let's get back to your entrepreneurs here. You see this in something like Yelp reviews. Take a look at Yelp reviews of restaurants. Just go in one day and look at how many of the reviews talk about what happened at the end of the meal. Somebody forgot their keys and the server ran into the parking lot to retrieve the keys for them. They got an unexpected dessert at the end. Wow, what a great place. Or there was a problem in the bill and the server was kind of a jerk about it. So endings have a disproportionately affect how we encode experiences. Endings also have this big effect on our motivation. Let me give you another kind of for give your listeners, because you're too well informed, give your listeners a question here. So think about at what age is somebody most likely to run his or her first marathon? If you look at the research on first time marathoners, the age at which people are most likely to run a marathon for the very first time is age 29. It's kind of peculiar. Why is that? 29-year-olds are twice as likely to run a first-time marathon as 30-year-olds and 28-year-olds. Makes no physiological reason. What's going on? They're reaching the end of a decade. That changes their motivation. Another age that people are likely to run marathons? 39. Another age that people are likely to run first-time marathons? 49. 49-year-olds are three times as likely to run a marathon for the first time as 50-year-olds. Why? It's one of the ways that endings affect our behavior. That when we see the end, we start to get more motivated. We kick a little harder.
You're telling me there's hope by saying 49 years old.
Yeah. So, I mean, how old are you?
Well, I'm still in my late 30s.
Oh, you got plenty of time. Do a 39-year-old run.
Well, I don't know about all that. Well, I'll shoot for 49.
Sure, 49. But, you know, 40. But I think that's kind of interesting. Just think about that for a second. 49-year-olds are three times more likely to run a first-time marathon than 50-year-olds. Now, is there a massive physiological difference between 49-year-olds and 50-year-olds? Does your body somehow undergo some kind of dramatic change at age 50? Absolutely not. It's all about this. It's all about this artificial ending of a decade. But endings of all kinds change our behavior. It's one of another interesting ways that timing affects what we do and how we do it.
So what about the beginnings? How could we start beginnings better to have better endings?
It's a great question. Beginnings exert a different kind of influence on us. So we talked about like the beginnings of school days. It should alarm us. It's a public health issue. It should alarm us what's going on with school start times, because you have higher dropout rates because school's starting too early. In other words, some kids are dropping out of school not because of, you know, their work ethic or their native ability, but because school starts too early. Now, there's also something really interesting, some research from Katie Milkman and others at the Wharton School, showing that we are more likely to begin some kind of behavior change at the beginnings rather than ends. So we're more likely to begin, say, a new diet. We're going to be more successful adhering to it, a new diet, if we start on a Monday versus a Thursday. If we started on the first of the month rather than the 13th of the month. If we started on the day after a federal holiday rather than the day before a federal holiday. That one of the things that we do, one of our cognitive quirks, is something called temporal accounting, all right? We sort of keep a ledger book in our head. And so when we get to, say, a Monday, let's say we had a bad week the previous week. When we get to a Monday, we say, you know what? I'm just going to close the ledger on that bad period and start with a fresh ledger and a fresh me, relegate old me to the past. New me, born anew on this Monday, is going to exercise more regularly.
What is something that the average listener could do starting tomorrow to be more cognizant, aware, or better, I guess, plan their day or week according to time?
Yeah, great question. So, as I mentioned, you know, if they should give the good news before the bad. I mean, they should give the bad news before the good news. There are a number of things that people can do. One of my favorite is this. There's some interesting research on how important breaks are in the course of a day. That my view is that breaks, the science of breaks, is where the science of sleep was 15 years ago. 15 years ago, you had people who would pull all-nighters, talk about how they only got 2 hours of sleep, come into the office, brag about it, and make the others of us who had a hard time doing that feel like, oh my gosh, I'm so frail, I'm so feckless, I'm not a hero like that guy. And then the science of sleep began penetrating emerged and reshaped our understanding. And we now know that that guy who was pulling the all-nighter is a fool. He's not a hero. He is hurting his own behavior. He's hurting his own performance. He's probably hurting his teammates' performance. And he's probably making mistakes that could be harmful down the road. And I think the science of breaks is where the science of sleep was 15 years ago, that we're now understanding that breaks are an important part of performance. The breaks are not a deviation from performance. They're part of performance itself. So to get to your direct question here, one of the things that I think can be transformative is on your to-do list or on your calendar for tomorrow, ClickSuasion listeners, what I'd like you to do is figure out 2 breaks that you're going to take and actually schedule your breaks. One of the things that we do is that we take meetings very seriously. We should take breaks as seriously as we take meetings. We always schedule meetings. We rarely skip them. We should treat breaks with the same reverence. So write down twice tomorrow when you're going to take a break. Now, there's no magic length of a break, but take a break for, 10 or 15 minutes. And what we know about breaks is that you're better off doing a social break rather than a solo break. You're better off moving rather than being stationary. You're much better off being fully detached rather than semi-detached. You're much better off having some exposure to nature rather than remaining indoors or in a windowless room. So tomorrow, write down twice, schedule it, 2 breaks, and treat it with the same reverence with which you treat meetings.
So I've learned some pretty good things here. So Dan, I've learned that I should align my calendar with my own behavior.
Yep.
I've learned to not get hit by a bus in the afternoon. And I've learned that when I do get hit by a bus, to be nice before I get hit by a bus as well.
Yeah, sure. I guess the bus would be a case of the bad news. The bad news, you got hit by a bus. The good news is that you're still going to live.
Agreed. Dan, when and where can we get when the scientific secrets of perfect timing?
The book is available at all reputable booksellers, online and offline. So you can go to your favorite online bookseller. You can go to your favorite chain store. You can go to your favorite independent. It's available as an ebook. It's available as an audiobook. If you want more information, you can always go to my website, which is danpink.com, danpink.com.
danpink.com. Go to his website, get the book, ClickSuasion listeners, subscribe to the podcast at ClickSuasion.com, and we'll let you know when the next episode is available. Dan, thank you so much.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for listening to ClickSuasion. Subscribe to the podcast, read our research, and get in touch with us at ClickSuasion.com. You can also find us on Twitter with the handle at ClickSuasion.